Thank you for joining me. I'm your host, Jason Coleman, and you are listening to Things That Make You Go, Book Review Podcast. And welcome to another episode of Things That Make You Go, Book Review Podcast. I am your one-man book club, Jason Coleman. Thank you so much for joining me. Sorry again that I haven't been around for a few weeks now for another podcast review, but hopefully this has given you some time to catch up on some of the older episodes if you haven't gotten a chance to do that. And I don't know, perhaps you've been reading some of your own stuff lately, and so this might be a good refresher if you're looking for something, some new recommendation, or something that, maybe you haven't considered reading yet. So today I'm actually going to be reviewing the book Better by Atul Gawande. Now, I should probably tell you right now that I am a huge Atul Gawande fan. I've been following some of his books for a long time. One of his books that he wrote, The Checklist Manifesto, is one of those books, I think, that I do read a lot of books, and mostly nonfiction, behaviorist psychology, behavioral economics, evolutionary psychology, those kind of things. And I try to give a bit of a perspective with my own viewpoint, my own experience with those books. But I think there comes a time, and generally those books make a difference on me. I certainly learn a bit from everything I read. There's always going to be a takeaway. But there are some books, I think, that are life-changing, meaning that I'm going to live my life differently after reading the book. And The Checklist Manifesto was one of those books. So if you haven't had a chance to read it, you know, please do yourself a favor and absolutely read the book. Okay, now, this particular book is called Better, and it's about Atul Gawande and his whole thought process behind how does somebody, or more importantly, how does an entire organization, how do they become better at something? How does an organization show improvement? And I suppose for myself, I think about better in terms of the individual very much, you know, and for that situation, there's a lot of ways that the individual can improve that aren't all that complicated. You can put in more effort. You can adjust your sleep schedule. You can adjust your eating schedule. You can manage your time more effectively, blah, blah, blah. But how does the organization itself become better? And that's a complicated question. And so what Atul Gawande does, and what I really like about this book, is he doesn't necessarily, and he's coming from the viewpoint of the medical background, because that's where he has made his living as a surgeon, spent his entire professional career. But he's not coming from the standpoint of, this is what I think it means to become better. He's trying to explain how organizations have become better at things. Okay, I don't necessarily know if it's going to be applicable to everyone. He does have a nice section in the back of the book where, towards the end, where he's talking a little bit about how the individual can strive to be better, but I'm not really sure that is the main focus of the book. I think the main focus of the book is just, he picks out a few different organizations and he picks out a few different situations and he tries to explain how those institutions have improved over time, and sometimes what the consequences are for improvement. And I'll talk a little, and what, you know, improvement even really means. So let me talk a little bit more about the book. All right. Now, the first thing that you should know is that things can be simple, but there's not always going to be an easy solution. So, for example, what he says is that he talks about how doctors just washing their hands was able to reduce infection rates at hospitals by like something like 30% or something overwhelming. And he talks about this one, I think it was a French doctor, who demanded that his physicians were constantly washing their hands at all times. But he said that it's very difficult to do, because if you're going from patient to patient, you have to use a special type of, I want to say, iodine-based soap that's going to completely disinfect you. And you have to actually wash your hands all the way from your fingertips down to close to your elbows. And he said, if you were to do that, you know, 15, 16 times a day, you probably wouldn't be able to get very much done with your patients. And he talks about himself, how he's walked into different, you know, when he was, I guess, an attending or something, when he would do different rounds and he would walk in and shake people's hands. And, you know, sometimes he would forget to wash his hands and he would just wipe his hands off on his wipe coat or something like that. And he says, every doctor does that. And I think that's kind of scary, because not necessarily because, you know, people can be being put at risk for infection, but we just have to kind of be realistic with, we know that something might be good for us, for the general, you know, for public health, but that doesn't necessarily mean everybody is going to get on board. And I just know from my own perspective as an educator that very often, I mean, every year when I start a school year, I've been doing this for almost 18 years now, there's always a series of new ideas that the staff is flooded with. And I would say maybe one in 20 of those ideas will persevere for more than, you know, two or three school years. And the reason why, I think, is there just isn't what they call buy-in. I mean, some people, they don't necessarily think the program is going to work, and so they don't necessarily implement it with fidelity. That's actually what I did my graduate research on when I was in graduate school, and I wanted to study about why classroom behavior programs to improve student behavior, why they are not more successful. And mostly the outcome I came to is the teachers just didn't really think they were going to work. And so some people implemented it, some people didn't. Then there was a frustration factor that set in, and then the program just kind of faded away. And so I just think about all the time and the money and the resources and training and bringing in consultants and, you know, having to listen to exasperated supervisors, how it all just doesn't really seem to add up to very much other than just a waste of time and resources, honestly. So anyway, getting back to his book here. So he was talking about how we have to, I think one of the big cruxes of his argument is one of the big questions we have to ask ourselves is, going forward with trying to improve systems or outcomes, is it better to invest in higher technology and, you know, research, or should we focus more on just improving the situations and the procedures that we have right now? I'm not sure I know exactly what the answer is. It seems to be, though, that I'm sure some combination of both is needed, but I think one is infinitely more accessible than the other. Because I know that in other, like, I think with, he talks about in Iraq, for example, combat veterans, and he was interviewing a combat surgeon in Iraq, and he was saying that, I didn't know this, but he pulled out some crazy statistic that said that there were more injuries, combat injuries, where soldiers survived than in like every other American war combined or something, that there was almost something like a 70 or 80% survival rate after traumatic war injuries. And he said what they started doing is, he talks about something called the golden hour, where if you suffer a serious injury but you're still alive, if medical professionals can get to you within 1 hour, then the likelihood of your survival increases, I don't know, something crazy, but like 75% or something. So what they used to do in the past is, if a soldier was injured and they brought him into a surgical trauma unit, they would try to just basically fix the soldier up the best that they could in that situation. But what they started doing is, somebody said that if they could just get basic recovery, if they could just say, for example, pack a wound so that, you know, to stop the bleeding profusely, maybe put in some certain sutures, control the vitals. And then what they would do is, they would just take a helicopter and they would move the soldier to a larger hospital with more resources. They would fix the soldier up a little bit more, move him on to another hospital. And so what they said was, they were able to get the surgery, they were able to, you know, perform life-saving surgery, and the window of when the surgery was happening back, you know, they said back in Vietnam, it would take about 3 weeks or something before the soldier could get to a fully operating surgical hospital. And they said by the time they had gotten to Iraq, they were able to so streamline the process that, like, something within 72 hours, they were able to get the soldier to a surgeon trauma hospital. And that in itself is a form of being better. But this is what I found fascinating. This is what I was talking about earlier. They didn't necessarily improve any sort of surgical procedures. They were still doing more or less the same thing that they'd been doing 20 years earlier. What was different was how they managed the process. So there wasn't necessarily any sophisticated technology that was put into the process here. The only thing that was different was how they went about organizing the process. So, I mean, I just as an aside, I was just thinking now that if you think about, I don't know, I think this applies more to cars that were built in the 80s and the 90s. I think that there was a reputation that Japanese cars had as working better, being more reliable, being more efficient than American cars. But if you think about Japanese auto building technology and you think about American auto building technology, even in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, it really wasn't that much different. It wasn't like they were using different parts. It wasn't as if they were, you know, using more sophisticated technology or computerized driving or anything like that. It was just basically a better design. It was a better way of pulling the components together. And maybe that might be something that we have to look at instead of going for some new amazing program. And I'm speaking directly to people who work in education. Maybe the solution might be just to figure out a way of better organizing this, you know, with the materials that we have now. All right. Now, the next thing that I wanted to say is that there's a fascinating discussion in the book about the death penalty. And he's trying to, and Atul Gawande is coming from the standpoint that we've gotten better at executing people. And he talks about how in the past, the death penalty was, you know, they used the electric chair, but that apparently wasn't always successful. And apparently, you know, the prisoners could be tortured. The electroshocks could be extremely devastating and painful. Then they talked about a firing squad, but sometimes the firing squad, sometimes they would miss different areas of the body. I read something incredible. Like apparently they were using the firing squad all the way up until the 70s or something. Then there was the whole thing about hanging, but the problem with hanging somebody is that people have different body weights, they have different body designs and facial shapes or whatnot, and that could all affect how quickly the asphyxiation process, and you know, sometimes it could just come out to be strangling somebody to death. So they settled on lethal injection, which you could anesthetize somebody, and then you could inject them, and they would be dead pretty quickly, and it would be a painless procedure. Well, here's the problem with that. The problem with that is that's a medical procedure. And Atul Gawande, who normally doesn't come out with too many political opinions that I could see, he actually does make a stand here. And he says that the problem is they're starting to bring in doctors and other medical professionals to assist with these executions. And the problem is that when doctors in America take the Hippocratic Oath when they graduate from medical school, they take an oath to not harm the patient. And so are these prisoners considered patients? And if they're not, then why is the doctor there? And if they are considered patients, then they cannot reasonably, with any moral conviction, state that they are doing the patient no harm. They're absolutely executing them against their will. And he says there are times when patients will feel pain, but Gawande says that he would never feel comfortable doing a procedure on a patient without the patient giving their consent. And with the death penalty, there is no consent. Okay. So the situation here now is that the doctor is now giving forcible treatment against the patient's will in a non-necessary medical emergency or a procedure. They don't need the procedure and they're getting it anyway. So what does that tell us? What we know now is that if we are going to become better at executing people, and I'm not even arguing about whether the death penalty, whether we should have it or whether we shouldn't. I personally am against it. I just feel that there's always going to be an inherent situation where people are going to be executed and then evidence will come out later on that may disprove their guilt, and you have a situation where you've now executed an innocent person. I'm against that. But that's not important. What's important is what Gawande is saying. What Gawande is saying here is that there are consequences to getting better at things, such as execution. It brings in moral questions that weren't there before. Another example in his next chapter, which I thought was fascinating, is he talks about women and birthing. And he was saying that childbirth was, up until maybe the late 1800s, was the most common cause of premature death in women. Very often there would be hemorrhaging that would kill the woman. So they came up with a bunch of different birthing procedures and strategies that, you know, really increased the mortality rate for both women and babies. And they talk about how one of the things that they would do is they just would use, and they go into this woman named Apgar, and I didn't know about this. They talk about the birthing Apgar score, where when a baby is born, they talk about, they score a baby from 1 to 10, I think, based upon a few different simple protocols. Are all of their limbs wiggling? Can they, are they able to project a cry at a certain volume? Are they breathing in normal bursts? So on and so forth. So, and if the baby has a lower Apgar score, like if their score is like, 7 to 10, then the baby is normal and healthy. If it's below 7, they found that if you could just, increase the oxygen levels, if you could increase, certain blood platelets or whatever the case is, I don't know all the neonatal terms, but just based upon this score, if you started administering procedures right off the bat, they were able to increase the mortality rates of babies, by some incredible margin. And apparently the Apgar scores are still what's used today for the birthing process. Now, here's the issue. The issue is that once one, obstetrician came up with this whole concept of using a tool that he designed that would be inserted into the woman's birth canal and could pull a baby out. Of course, this tool is called the forceps. And there's this, Gawande goes into this fascinating discussion about how, even the obstetricians, they kept it a family secret because they didn't think the public would, would want to. Because when you see the forceps, it looks like a bit of a medieval torture device that you're inserting this into a woman and, pulling out the child with it. It looks pretty barbaric. But what they found with the forceps, over time it became, a widely accepted medical process. And it was able, and the doctors were able to use this contraption with great success to assist with birthing. And apparently, I didn't know this, but the standard procedure now, if there's any complications with a woman's birth, they almost always go to the cesarean section, which is where they basically cut open a woman's womb and remove the baby. Now, they were saying that when you do this, there could be tons of scarring for the woman. Having future childbirths, like it's very difficult, if not impossible, to birth the child through the vaginal canal after that happens. There's going to be a longer recovery time for the woman. And aesthetically, there's just a lot of scarring. It doesn't look very, appealing. I think most women are probably pretty self-conscious of it. So the question then is, how did the cesarean section replace the forceps? And so again, we're talking about, becoming better. And they were saying that the cesarean section is so successful that, it's something like, it used to be like one in, every 100, I should be a little bit better about writing down these statistics, but basically the mortality rate for babies went from like, five in every 1,000 to like 0.1 in every 1,000, babies that would die during childbirth. So the question then is, if forceps they found were just as effective as the cesarean section, how did the cesarean section replace forceps as the standard procedure for when women are having trouble with childbirth? And what they found is that it's not really a fair statistic to compare using forceps with the cesarean section, because with this, the C-section, the cesarean section, all surgeons are taught the practice. I mean, not surgeons, but all obstetricians are taught the practice. Every single one of them knows it. that graduate from medical school. But they were saying that forceps are something that takes training. It takes nuance. You have to be familiar with how babies are likely to exit the birth canal. You have to get good with, managing and twisting and turning and a lot of other different techniques that obstetricians basically don't know. And I think about myself, and I know this is a bit of a bizarre connection, but please try to follow me for a second. Recently, our air conditioner broke, and we have a very old unit. The unit's over 20 years old, and we called in a few different air conditioning repair people to get a couple of different estimates on getting our air conditioner repaired. And without fail, every single one of them basically just wanted to replace the entire AC system. And so I got to reading a little bit on the internet because I thought, why did all of them just want to replace the system? None of them even tried to repair the unit. Well, the reality is they don't know how. Replacing an air conditioning unit is much easier than actually having to look and see where a leak might be, then having to order the parts that might be necessary, then operating on an older machine, which most AC, install people don't really know how to do. It's just easier and more secure if they just rip out the whole system and put in a new one. Well, that's what they found with C-sections, is that, maybe you could, use the forceps and train people, and some people will be better than others. But honestly, everybody, if you wanted to standardize a procedure where everybody is using it and it's effective across the board, then the C-section would just be king. And that's why that's the preferred procedure. But what they found is that what's disturbing is apparently over the last 40 years, C-sections during a female birth went from something like 5% to close to 40% or something like that. So that's pretty scary to me, because similar to the AC repair people, if an obstetrician feels like there's going to be any chance of a birthing problem, I just don't think they're going to go through a whole series of steps of, trying to figure out different ways of wiggling the baby out. I think they're just going to go right to the C-section. They don't want to take any chances, because then there's medical and legal liabilities as well. And there's a whole section in the book where Atul Gawande talks about, how obstetricians are the people who are sued the most frequently. They have the highest medical malpractice insurance and, so on and so forth. So anyway, I don't want to give away the whole book. I've already told you about some of the big parts. It's really a fascinating study about what it means to become better. There's a section about how this one doctor named Warwick improved the lifespan, maybe even single-handedly, of people with cystic fibrosis by, 10, 15, possibly 20 years using his procedures. And again, it just really comes down to how committed is the individual? How committed is the organization? Is there an internal drive to get better? Is there going to be buy-in from all people involved? Is there going to be accountability? What's the accountability going to be look like? Will there be data collections? Will people be reviewing data collections and looking for improvement? It's difficult. These are tough conversations to have, and there's probably going to be no easy answers. But anyway, I'm pretty close to getting to where I wanted to be with these podcasts. So I hope you enjoyed my discussion of the book Better by Atul Gawande. Like I said, he's a fascinating writer. I recommend this book. I recommend his book on mortality. I recommend his book, The Checklist Manifesto. So Better by Atul Gawande. Until next time, I'm going to be going on vacation because it is my summer break. And believe me, I need it after this long school year. So I'm not exactly sure when I'm coming back with another podcast, but I'll come back with something eventually for you guys, I promise. So until then, happy reading.